I want you to close your eyes for a second. Just picture yourself at 13, maybe 14 years old.
Oh boy.
You're sitting at the dinner table, your body's changing, hormones are just screaming, and you're trying to figure out who on earth you even are.
Right.
And across from you, your parents ask a simple question, something like, "How was school?" But to you, it feels like a total interrogation.
Of
You
course.
roll your eyes, you sigh, maybe you slam a door.
The classic storm and stress. I mean, it's practically a biological rite of passage for every teenager on the planet.
Exactly. It's universal. But now I want you to take all that volatility and just drop it into a pressure cooker.
Okay.
Imagine while you're having that same identity crisis, you're also in a completely new country. Maybe you don't really speak the language that well. Maybe the kids at school make fun of your lunch. And your parents, they aren't just uncool anymore. They are operating from a completely different cultural manual.
That is a massive amplifier. You're talking about migration, which psychologists rank as, one of the most stressful life events a person can go through.
It's up there with what? Divorce?
Divorce, the death of a loved one, it's huge.
And that right there, that brings us to the core mission of today's deep dive. We have this massive stack of research here, a major study by Abatoye and colleagues from 2023, and it asks a really fundamental question.
Which is?
When a family goes through that migration pressure cooker, what actually happens to the bonds?
Does the stress tear them apart?
Or does it force them to like circle the wagons and become tighter than ever?
It's the ultimate tug of war, really, between risk and resilience. And what makes this deep dive so special is that we aren't just using anecdotes or, movie scripts. We are looking at hard data.
And when you say hard data, you mean a lot of data. This isn't a survey of 10 people in a coffee shop.
Oh, not even close. We're talking about the responses of over 146,000 adolescents. These are 11, 13, and 15-year-olds living in 30 different receiving countries, mostly Europe, but also Canada and Israel. And their families come from 178 different origin countries.
So this is a genuinely global snapshot. And honestly, the results, they shook me a little. It challenges so many of the stories we tell ourselves about immigrant families.
Both the tragic ones and the heroic ones.
Totally. But okay, before we get to the findings, we need to define our terms. Let's do this science made simple style. When these researchers say family support, what are they actually measuring?
That's a great question.
Because my first thought is, are mom and dad paying for soccer practice? Are they driving me to school? That kind of thing.
Right, and that would be what sociologists call instrumental support, like logistical help. That's not what this study was about. They were looking for something deeper, emotional support. They used this survey that asks four, let's call them big questions.
I have them right here. Question one, does my family really try to help me? Question two, do I get the emotional help I need? Three, can I talk about my problems with them? And four, are they willing to help me make decisions?
Think about what those questions are getting at. It's not about money or rides. It's about availability and safety and guidance.
It's that feeling that my family is my secure base.
Exactly. It's the feeling that when the world outside is chaotic, home is safe.
Okay, so with that definition in mind, that emotional safety net, let's go back to those two competing theories you mentioned, risk versus resilience. And if I'm a betting man, I have a really strong gut feeling about this one.
Okay, walk me through your bet. Which way do you think the scale tips?
Well, I mean, I watch movies, I see the pop culture stuff. On one hand, you've got the risk perspective.
The greedy realism.
Yeah, migration is hard. You might be poor, you might face racism, your parents' degrees are useless, so they're working two jobs. All that stress has to go somewhere, right? So logically, it comes home.
It makes the parents irritable or depressed, and the kid feels it.
Right. That's the standard sociological family stress model. Economic pressure leads to emotional distance.
It's a very well-documented phenomenon.
Sure. But then you have the resilience perspective.
The use against the world theory.
Exactly. The immigrant family that eats dinner together every night, respects their elders, they stick together because that's all they have. I feel like they have to be tighter knit, just to survive.
So your bet is on resilience.
My bet is on resilience. I'd bet that immigrant kids feel more supported than the local kids because the family is their fortress.
That is a very compassionate bet, and it actually aligns with what we call the immigrant optimism hypothesis. But
Oh.
if you place that bet at the casino of sociology, you would have lost.
Really?
When the researchers crunched the numbers from all those 30 countries, a really clear hierarchy emerged. And at the very top, reporting the absolute highest levels of emotional support were the non-immigrant adolescents.
The locals.
The locals.
Okay, so kids born in the country to parents born in the country feel the most supported. Who's next?
In the middle, you have the second generation immigrants. These are the kids born in the new country, but their parents were born abroad.
Right.
And at the very bottom, reporting the lowest levels of support were the first generation immigrants, the kids who actually moved themselves.
So the risk perspective was right. The stress of migration actually does degrade that feeling of support.
Technically, yes. The hierarchy is statistically significant. But, and I need to put a giant asterisk here because this is where science communication so often fails, we have to talk about the effect size.
Okay, explain effect size to me like I'm five, or at least like I'm someone who definitely skips statistics class.
Okay. Imagine a race. You have runner A, the non-immigrant, and runner B, the immigrant.
Got it.
Runner A wins the race. The photo finish shows runner A is clearly ahead. So statistically, runner A is faster.
Makes sense.
But when you look at the actual times, runner A finished in 10.0 seconds and runner B finished in 10.1.
So one of them won, but they're both incredibly fast.
Yeah.
It wasn't a blowout.
Exactly. And that's what the researchers are emphasizing. While the ranking is clear, the difference between the groups is small. On a 5-point scale, almost every single group was averaging above a 4.
Wait, so everyone's basically getting an A or a B plus in family support?
Precisely. It's not that immigrant families are broken or in crisis, not at all. It's just that they're carrying a slightly heavier backpack, you know?
Okay.
They're dealing with just enough extra friction that it depresses that score by a fraction of a point compared to the locals.
That is a really crucial distinction. We're not talking about dysfunction. We're talking about a slight drag on the system. It's a trend, not a tragedy.
Correct. Although there was one fascinating exception to this entire hierarchy, a place where the rules just flipped upside down.
Let me guess. You're talking about the Israel data point.
You got it. I saw you circled it.
I circled it three times. In Israel, the second generation immigrants actually reported higher family support than the non-immigrants. They beat the locals.
Ooh.
Why? Why is Israel so different from, say, France or Sweden?
Well, the study really highlights this as a special case. Israel is a nation that's explicitly built on the concept of immigration, the Aliyah.
The whole national ethos is about gathering people from the diaspora.
Right. So if you move to Germany, you might feel like an outsider trying to get in. But if you move to Israel as a Jewish immigrant, the state itself is essentially saying, welcome home.
And that changes the whole dynamic.
The researchers suspect that this feeling of national belonging just trickles down into the family. If the society welcomes you, the family feels less besieged, less defensive, and that bond actually strengthens.
But in most of Europe and Canada, the standard pattern held.
It did. Locals first, then second gen, then first gen.
Okay, so we've established the what, now we need the why. And this is where the study gets really cool, because the researchers basically played detective. They rounded up a bunch of suspects to see what was causing this gap.
Right. They used a statistical method called multi-level modeling.
Whoa, hold on. Multi-level what now? Let's use an analogy.
Okay, let's make it simple. Think of it like a layer cake.
I love cake analogies. Go on.
The bottom layer of the cake is the individual kid. The middle layer is their family. And the top layer is the country they live in.
Yeah.
The researchers wanted to see if the flavor of that top layer, you know, the country's politics and atmosphere, was somehow ruining the taste of the bottom layers.
And they looked at three really nasty ingredients for that top layer. Let's list them. Suspect one, restrictive integration policies.
This is the government making it hard for you. Tough citizenship laws, difficult family reunification.
Basically, the system saying, you are not welcome here legally.
Right. Suspect two, anti-immigrant attitudes. This is the vibe from the neighbors. Do the locals think you're stealing their jobs? Do they associate you with crime?
So you are not welcome here socially.
Exactly. And suspect three was immigrant density. The theory being, if there are fewer people like you, you feel more isolated. If there are lots, you have a safety net.
So the hypothesis was simple. If you live in a country with hostile laws, racist neighbors, and no community, your family support scores should just tank.
The stress from the outside should break the home on the inside.
It seems completely obvious. If the world outside hates you, your parents are stressed, and they just can't support you as well.
It does seem obvious, and yet the data said nothing.
Nothing.
Zero correlation. None of those three factors, not the laws, not the attitudes, not the density, significantly explained the gap in family support.
I need a second on this. You're telling me a family in a country with friendly laws and nice neighbors has the same support gap as a family in a country that's actively hostile to them? That feels deeply counterintuitive.
It shocked the researchers, too. It goes against all their predictions. But it reveals something pretty profound about the family unit. It's what I call the dinner table versus parliament distinction.
Meaning, what happens in the legislature doesn't dictate what happens in the kitchen.
Pretty much. A parent might face discrimination at work, they might worry about their visa, but when they walk through that front door, they don't necessarily take that out on their child.
In fact, they might do the opposite.
They might compartmentalize it. They might try harder to be a supportive parent, specifically to shield their child from that harsh reality.
So the family becomes a kind of bunker. The shelling outside doesn't determine the morale inside.
Or, and the study suggests this too, maybe our measures of immigrant density were just too broad.
How so?
Knowing that 10% of your city is foreign-born doesn't help you if none of them speak your language. A specific Little Italy or Chinatown might provide support, but just a generic immigrant category doesn't create a real safety net.
That's a fair point. But still, the headline here is that external politics didn't break the internal bond.
Right.
Which leaves us with a huge mystery.
Right.
If it's not the laws and it's not the neighbors, what is dragging down those support scores? Because something is.
This is the real aha moment of the paper. When they stripped away the politics, they found the real culprit hiding in plain sight. It wasn't about where the family was.
It was about the distance.
The distance between where they came from and where they are now. They call this cultural distance.
Right. And to measure this, they use this fascinating tool, the Kogut Singh Cultural Distance Index.
It sounds incredibly technical, I know.
Yeah, let's break that down for the non-scientists among us.
Think of it as a cultural tape measure. It calculates the mathematical difference between the values of the origin country and the receiving country.
And for this study, they focus on one specific dimension that is absolutely critical for parenting.
Obedience versus independence.
Okay, let's define those, because I think we all have a vague idea. But what does the study mean by them?
So in many origin cultures, and yes, we're generalizing, but think parts of Asia, Africa, the Middle East, South America, the value system is often collectivist. There's high premium on obedience.
Respect authority. Defer to your elders. Don't make waves.
Exactly. Prioritize the group's harmony. Honor thy father and mother.
And maybe stay home until you're married.
Right. Now, compare that to the receiving cultures, mostly Western Europe, Canada. These societies value independence.
Autonomy. Self-reliance.
The goal of parenting there is to raise a child who challenges authority, who asks why, who thinks for themselves.
So you have a family moving from an obedience culture to an independence culture.
And the study found that the greater this cultural distance, the wider that gap between those two value systems, the lower the reported family support.
And this is where the plot really thickens. Who did this impact the most?
The second generation.
The kids born in the new country, not the ones who moved.
Exactly. And this brings us to the core mechanism, what they call the acculturation gap.
Mm.
This is the real friction point.
Okay, walk us through a scenario. What does this gap look like on a Tuesday night?
Okay. Imagine a family from a traditional obedience-heavy culture moves to, say, the Netherlands or Canada. They have a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
The parents are still operating on their original software. We protect the family. We make decisions for the child. The child respects our decisions. That's how they were raised. And they believe it's the right way to raise a child.
But the daughter, she goes to school in Toronto or Amsterdam.
She is soaking up the new software. She sees her friends negotiating their curfews. She sees them choosing their own clothes, their own partners, their own careers. She starts to value autonomy.
So she comes home and says, I want to go to this party, or I want to study art, not engineering.
And the parents don't just see that as a simple difference of opinion. Through their cultural lens, they see it as a rejection of the family itself.
As disrespect.
As disrespect. So they clamp down, they try to enforce obedience because in their minds, they think they're saving her.
And the daughter interprets that clamping down not as protection, but as a lack of support.
Right.
She's the one answering the survey saying, no, my parents don't help me make decisions. They make decisions for me.
Bingo. That is the friction. The kid feels the parents are blocking their development. The parents feel the kid is abandoning their values. That mismatch is why the second generation scores lower.
While the first generation kids, the ones who moved, they might still remember the old country.
They still have some of that obedient software installed.
Mm-hmm.
They get where mom and dad are coming from, the second gen kid. They are completely caught between two worlds.
It's like the parents are living in a time capsule of their home country, and the kid is living in the future.
That is a perfect analogy. It's a temporal and a cultural disconnect.
You know, what's so vital to mention here, and the study is really clear on this, is that coming from an obedience culture wasn't inherently bad on its own.
No, that is a crucial correction. We shouldn't fall into the trap of thinking Western independence parenting is just better. The study looked at whether simply being from an obedience culture predicted lower support, and it didn't. There's nothing inherently worse about authoritarian or collectivist parenting. It provides incredible security and structure.
So it's not the culture itself, it's the mismatch.
It is the friction. If you are an obedience family in an obedient society, everything is harmonious. If you're an independence family in an independent society, you're fine. But if you're an obedience family trying to operate in an independent society, that's where the gears grind.
So we have this picture of this second-gen kid feeling that squeeze. But I want to zoom out for a second. We've spent a lot of time dissecting the gap, but we started by saying the overall scores were actually high.
We did. And we can't lose sight of the forest for the trees here. Despite the cultural distance, despite the policy hurdles, despite all the stress of migration, the average family support score was remarkably high across all groups.
And this leads the researchers to talk about universals in parenting.
It's a beautiful concept, really. It suggests that love is the constant variable. Whether a parent values strict obedience or total independence, the underlying drive is just care.
It's just the expression of that care that differs.
Exactly. A strict parent restricts you because they love you. A lenient parent lets you go because they love you.
And even if there's a kind of translation error between the generations, even if the kid doesn't fully get the parent's style, that fundamental bond holds.
It bends, but it rarely breaks. The family unit is surprisingly robust. It resists the political climate. It resists the laws. It even, for the most part, resists the culture shock.
So what does this mean for us? If I'm listening to this, and maybe I'm a parent or a teacher, or I just have neighbors who are immigrants, What's the practical takeaway? We can't just change our cultural software overnight.
I think the biggest takeaway is that we need to stop looking at integration as something that just happens on the streets or in the workplace. The real front line of integration is the dining room table.
It's that negotiation between the parents' expectations and the kids' new reality.
Right. And for the second generation, that struggle is often totally invisible to the outside world. They speak the language perfectly. They fit in at school. You look at them and think, oh, they're fully integrated.
But at home, they're navigating this complex peace treaty between two different rule books.
Exactly. And it also tells us that you can't just fix family dynamics by passing better laws. I mean, better laws are good for a lot of other reasons, jobs, rights, safety. But the study shows they won't magically fix the argument about curfew inside an immigrant home.
No.
That requires empathy. It requires understanding that cultural distance. If you're a counselor or a teacher, you need to realize that a parent you see as controlling might actually be a protective parent operating under a completely different cultural code.
And realizing that a kid you see as rebellious might just be an adapting child trying to survive in their new world.
Precisely. It's about reframing the conflict not as bad parenting versus bad kid, but as a clash of values where both sides actually want the same thing. Success and safety for the child.
I think this really flips the script on how we talk about immigrant families. We tend to focus on the external struggles, racism, poverty, language. And those are real.
Very real.
But this study says, hey, don't forget the internal struggle, the struggle of values.
And that internal struggle is where that emotional support system really lives or dies.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, I'm left thinking about that resilience we talked about at the start.
Mm-hmm.
We asked if migration breaks families. The answer seems to be no. It stresses them. It creates this specific type of friction for the kids born in the new land. But the foundation holds.
It holds. But I have to leave you with a bit of a provocative question, one that the study alludes to but can't fully answer.
What's that?
We were surprised that hostile politics and anti-immigrant attitudes didn't statistically lower the family support scores. We called it a victory for the family unit.
Right. The dinner table defense. The bunker.
But we have to ask, at what cost? Does that finding mean the family is truly invincible? Or does it mean that immigrant families are absorbing that toxicity in ways this survey just couldn't measure?
What do you mean by that?
Well, maybe they are supporting each other, but the quality of that support is strained. Maybe the parents are acting as a shield, just absorbing all the racism and stress so the kids don't feel it, but the parents themselves are burning out.
That is a heavy thought.
Yeah.
The cost of resilience. Just because the kids check the box saying, "I feel supported," that doesn't mean providing that support isn't costing their parents everything they have.
Precisely. The data shows the success, but it hides the effort. It hides the incredible emotional labor required to keep that bond strong in a hostile world.
It's something to mull over next time you see a family navigating a new world. They might look like they have it all figured out, but there is a whole world of negotiation and sacrifice happening behind closed doors.
Indeed. It's a reminder that resilience isn't free.
Thanks for guiding us through the data today.
My pleasure.
And to everyone listening, keep asking questions, look beneath the surface, and we will see you on the next deep dive.